Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our websites, CompassionateCooks.com and JoyOfVeganBaking.com. Hi, everybody. How are you doing? It's good to be here. I don't know if you know the Yiddish word plots, to plots. To plots means to basically explode. David and I use this word all the time. Like, you know, if something's too cute, you plots. If something's too overwhelming, you plots. You know, like, oh my God, Simon and Schuster were so adorable today. They were just so cute. It just made me plots, like that kind of thing. So I hope you take this as a compliment, but all of you make me plots. I have been getting more emails than ever before as word of mouth grows about this podcast and as we attract more listeners. And every one of your emails and letters makes me plots because you're just too much. I'm so impressed and amazed by the response I've been getting. So seriously, thank you so much for your emails and for taking the time to let me know what this podcast means to you. I'm not just saying this, and I know I've been saying it a lot lately, so you're just going to have to get used to me thanking you, but it's been really a pleasure to hear from all of you. The sponsors of today's episode make me plots every time they send me an email. They're just incredible. I've heard from them a couple times, and I had the pleasure of meeting them when they were in town. They came to one of my cooking classes, and they've become the most amazing activist in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I'm so impressed with them. Tanya Smith and Brian Sula, they sponsored the podcast in honor of their two-year wedding anniversary, which is just so lovely. And here's what Tanya had to say. Thanks, Colleen, for everything you do. I just wanted to send a note to say how inspiring your podcast has been. My husband and I are having such an easy time living our vegan life this time around. We are longtime vegetarians, but became vegan in July of 2007. Last time we tried being vegan a couple years ago, it lasted only 6 months. Now we are truly experiencing the joy of doing no harm and walking the walk, living by example, and every other cliche you can think of. You had a lot to do with our journey, so we want to show our appreciation for all the work you do to bring us these wonderful podcasts. Thank you so much. I am experiencing the joyful vegan feeling and looking forward to the rest of our lives, not contributing to the suffering on a personal level. I'm also looking forward to becoming more active. And boy, have they. Here's another email I got from Tanya not long after that first email. She said, "We just got home from the Milwaukee Walk for Farm Animals to benefit Farm Sanctuary. It was very well received for the most part, with a lot of people asking for literature. We joined Citizens United for Animals, CUFA, and we'll be going to a vegan Halloween party hosted by the president of CUFA. In a few weeks, we'll be doing a TV trailer showing Meet Your Meat on a double-sided video trailer with CUFA outside a popular upscale local supermarket and handing out literature. All of this is thanks to the inspiration we've experienced from listening to all of your podcasts." And then another follow-up email. "At the TV trailer event, we had a fifth grade little boy who was hanging around and asking lots of questions. He was horrified at how the animals are treated for food and watched the Meet Your Meat video as many times as it looped. He asked to help us hand out leaflets and took a huge pile to take to school with him. He was going to visit the PETA 2 website and see if they would send him some games and stuff for school. It was amazing. He would not give up. When couples exited the supermarket, he would say, 'Excuse me, sir, would you like some free information?' And when the man said, 'No, thank you,' he would plead in this adorable little voice, 'How about you, ma'am, please?' And they would invariably accept it. He's going to make quite the activist. We had quite a few wonderful receptive reactions from people at that event. Even the butcher from the supermarket was standing and watching through the window, and he accepted some leaflets that we offered him." So they're just incredible people, and they're just another example of how our convictions and active values create a ripple effect all over the place. So thank you so much, Brian and Tanya, for your support, and most of all for being a voice for the animals. Keep up the fantastic work. I'm so proud of you. If you would like to help this podcast carry on, please consider becoming a sponsor. You can decide the level. You can go to CompassionateCooks.com and click on Support Our Podcast, and you can become a monthly sponsor or a one-time sponsor. Whatever you can do is a huge help, and I thank you on behalf of the animals. So it's time to talk about chickens. We haven't talked about chickens yet. And on one hand, we admire chickens immensely, particularly female chickens, also known as hens. We're very conscious of the loyalty a hen has for her offspring. To be a mother hen is to be a person who cares for the needs of others in a very protective way, just as hens care for their offspring. And this is something we really admire. Just the image of a baby chick, a little chick with soft yellow downy feathers, is enough to soften the hardest heart. And it represents perfection, just perfect innocence and vulnerability, new life, and it's most likely the universal symbol of cuteness. Chickens live in flocks, and they shame humans with their complex social system, their communal order, the system we call a pecking order. And in terms of beauty, there is nothing that compares with the plumage of a rooster. The colors on some roosters are just absolutely unbelievable. So there's a lot we have to admire about chickens and roosters. And Susie Costin, the National Shelter Director for Farm Sanctuary, she's basically the mama to all the babies at the sanctuary in New York. She's told me some amazing stories about roosters and chickens, just really wonderful things. And I thought I would share a couple stories with you. So roosters are very protective of their hens. And Susie has seen many cases where the rooster's communication with the girls has literally saved their lives. Mayfly, for example, is a gorgeous rooster who's been at the sanctuary since he was a baby. He was rescued from a botched classroom hatching project, and he's notorious for running all of his hens into the barn whenever there's danger. He goes from hen to hen and actually herds them back into the barn, screaming the whole time when a hawk is around. And chickens have over 20 vocalizations that are recognizable to humans. So most likely they have more than that for communication with each other, things that we can't recognize, subtleties that we can't pick up on. When there's a food treat, there's a very specific sound the rooster makes, calling the hens to the food. And most roosters then allow the hens to eat first before they begin. Even the Talmud, it commends the courtesy of a rooster. In the Talmud, it refers to the fact that roosters call to their hens when he finds something good to eat, and he doesn't eat until they do. It's a very distinct call. It's different from the clucking and the crowing. And while giving this call, he repeatedly picks up a morsel of food, and then he drops it again to attract the attention of the hens. It's really lovely to watch. And of course, the mother hen uses a similar call and action to teach her chicks to feed. Susie also tells of a hen named Junebug, who was a spent layer hen that had been used in a kaparot ceremony, or was supposed to be used in a kaparot ceremony. This ceremony is a Jewish ritual that takes place around Yom Kippur, in which live chickens are killed in this ceremonious way. But luckily, Junebug was rescued and she lived, and she was brought to Farm Sanctuary from the city. And by the way, when I say spent layer hen, that refers to the fate of all hens who are bred specifically for egg production and whose bodies are so broken and spent after about a year or so. And once they're spent, once they're no longer profitable, they're sold to slaughter, of course, and they end up in processed meat items where consumers really can't see all the bruises and the injuries on their bodies from such a hard life of servitude. And so they end up as chicken soup or in chicken pot pie or something like that. Now, in Junebug's case, she was sold to be killed for this ritual. And when she arrived at the sanctuary, she was pretty sick, which is common for spent layer hens whose calcium and other minerals have been completely depleted from their bodies in order to produce eggs in such a rapid way. So needless to say, she got a lot of attention when she first came to the sanctuary. And once she was better and checked out health-wise, she began to live in the kitchen. And she would share lunch with anybody who was eating there. She also would peck at the door if she heard somebody on the other side, a little knock as she would give. And at one point, the shelter got a kitten who was very sick and actually ended up dying at Cornell the day she was dumped at the farm. But when she arrived, a staff member brought her into the kitchen, and Junebug went over and sat on her like a mother hen would do. And the kitten popped up her little head, and then she fell asleep. And Junebug kept her wings out to the side like mothers do, and she actually puffed at the staff when they had to take the kitten away. It was really just so lovely, so beautiful and sweet, and which is just so typical of these amazing animals. This story also reminds me actually of one that Kim Sterla told me many years ago. Kim Sterla is the founder of Animal Place. It's also a farmed animal sanctuary here in California. And she told me about a hen named Mary and a rooster named Notorious Boy was his name. And Mary was a Rhode Island Red. She was a stray chicken found at the city dump in Palo Alto. And she was an older chicken, and she had been seriously debeaked, so her face was somewhat deformed, and she really appeared as if she had lived a very hard life. But Kim said she had this kind of elegant confidence despite looking very old and a little ragged. And Notorious Boy came to the sanctuary shortly after Mary, and he bonded with her right away. The two of them stayed together constantly, and they never hung out with the other animals. They just stayed together all the time. And they would roost on the picnic table together. That was their favorite spot. And Kim tells the story of seeing them one really rainy, windy night, and she saw them there in their spot on the picnic table. And there was Mary cuddled up closely to Notorious Boy, right up against his body. And Notorious Boy held up his wing in front of Mary to protect her from the wind and the rain. And as he protected her, he just held his head up high as if to say he could not be prouder to be her protector. And Kim said it was just so beautiful. So mother hens do that. I mean, you know, they're really protective and sweet. And Susie's told me that at the sanctuary, they've had mothers with their chicks. And some of these mothers continue to sleep on top of their babies, even when the babies are larger than their mother. So it's just so cute. But to see a rooster protecting his girl that he's in love with is just too much. So there's much to love about chickens. But unfortunately, they may very well be the most abused animal on the planet. The domestic chicken, the chicken we think about when we think of chickens, when we think of them at all, was domesticated from what we call the jungle fowl. These are gorgeous, gorgeous animals. They're wild animals. They still roam free in some places, mostly in tropical climates, and they're just incredible. We saw them roaming around and hanging around when we were in Hawaii, and they're just a sight to see with their iridescent plumage. They're absolutely stunning. They really are stunning. But the chickens we think of today, the ones that we have genetically manipulated to be the most popular source of meat on the planet, and the ones we've genetically manipulated to be egg machines, are very different than their ancestors. They're not different in terms of their needs. They're not different in terms of their interests. And they're not different in terms of their ability to suffer. But they are different, very different, in terms of what they look like, how fast they grow, and how long they live, if a living is a fitting word for the imprisonment we've created for them within their own little bodies. And I must say that my heart breaks whenever I hear someone say, well, I only eat white meat and I don't eat red meat at all, as if it's somehow noble to eat one animal and not another. And I realize that part of their declaration stems from the fact that our culture has made it a bit taboo to eat red meat. And I think that has to do with the fact that people think red meat is unhealthful and white meat is healthful, and yet they both have pretty much the same amount of cholesterol and pretty much the same amount of saturated fat, and you still have the animal protein, you still have all these other problems with it. And the pork industry has perpetuated this whole idea that white meat is somehow healthier. In 1987, due to falling pork sales and increasing poultry sales, they created a very, very successful campaign, an ad campaign that was called Pork, the Other White Meat. I'm sure you remember that, and that furthered that perception. I also think there are reasons that lead people to feel that they're doing something good by eliminating red meat and eating only white meat. And I think some of it has to do with the fact that cattle are mammals, which means that people can identify with them a little more. They can see things in their face or in their eyes that look like them. And so they feel that they can identify more. And I also think the size of the animal has something to do that just affects people. I don't quite know what that's about, but it seems that the idea of, you know, killing this large, you know, 2,000 pound animal in the case of a cow or a steer is just so much more egregious than you know, kind of killing one small bird after another. There's something there that has to do with size. And of course, people don't see chickens as animals, so that's another reason I think it just makes it easier for them to order their death. They just don't see them as animals. And I talked about this a little bit in an episode, I think, called, what was it, The Language of Meat, I think it was called, where I talked about how we've completely taken the animal out of the chicken. So when we say something like, do you eat chicken? It's, you know, we don't even think about chicken being an animal. But if we were to say, do you eat chickens? You know, plural, people would say, well, I don't eat chickens. Like, it just kind of puts the animal back into that word. So anyway, I think that's pretty interesting. I'm reluctant to quantify suffering, especially when in the end all of the animals experience the same pain, the same fear, the same death. I do think it's accurate to say that if we think we're doing right by cattle, by eating only chickens, in reality, we are actually inflicting a lot more suffering on chickens and other birds than we do onto cattle. So quantifiably, we are creating a lot more suffering in this world by eating the number of chickens that we are eating. This suffering is obvious not only in what we've done to their little bodies and how we confine them while they're alive, but these animals, all birds, turkeys and chickens and ducks and geese, even rabbits who are classified as poultry by the USDA, all of these animals are exempt from the Humane Slaughter Act. Now, this act is pretty unenforced and it does little to protect the animals who do fall under its umbrella, but it's an act nonetheless that does not include these birds, and it leads to egregious, horrific abuse on the slaughter line. Now, we often hear numbers thrown around, 10 billion land animals, 45 billion land and sea animals killed for human consumption every year in the United States. And though those numbers are pretty hard to wrap our brains around, the most difficult thing about these numbers is that they keep going up. These numbers, 10 billion land animals and 45 billion animals altogether, including aquatic animals, refer only to the U.S. deaths, and these numbers are increasing all around the world, and these numbers keep increasing every year in the U.S. Some of this has to do with human population growth, obviously, but it can be pretty disconcerting when you look back, and I look back at my notes from several years ago, and the numbers were 6 billion, which is pretty high, but now we're well into the 10 billion number. So when we hear that number today, that 10 billion land animals are killed for human consumption every year in the United States, I don't think most of us realize that 9 billion of that 10 billion are chickens and other birds. So let me break this down for you a bit, and you can find this information at the USDA website, or FARM, F-A-R-M, Farm Animal Reform Movement, compiles these numbers every year so that we know how many victims there are in animal agriculture. In 2007, 10,378,000,000 animals were killed for human consumption in the United States. 10,378,000,000. And to be sure, this number includes not only those who were reported as slaughtered by the USDA, it also includes over 925 million animals, about 9% of the total, who died slow, painful, lingering deaths from disease, from malnutrition, injury, suffocation, stress, and other deadly practices in the industry. This number includes the 213 million males who were dumped to suffocate slowly in plastic garbage bags upon hatching. They're the males that are useless to the egg-laying industry, and 213 million of them are killed every year just because they're males. 10,378,000,000. So of this 10,378,000,000, 39 million are cattle and calves. And these include the calves that are raised from dairy cows, who, of course, are also killed because if a female dairy cow has a male, they're useless to the dairy industry, so they're killed. So that 39 million includes those babies. 121 million pigs, which is up from 118 million from 2006. So 121 million pigs are killed every year. 4 million sheep and goats. 10 million rabbits. 317 million turkeys, and that's up from 302 million in 2006, 28 million ducks, 9,409,000,000 chickens raised specifically for their flesh. These are called broilers in the industry. So 9,409,000,000 broilers were killed, and 450 million spent layer hens, 450 million every year. So keep in mind that the number of fishes and other aquatic organisms killed for human and animal consumption is not reported by any agency. They don't have to report these numbers, but the numbers most likely exceed this 10 billion. People estimate that it's around 35 billion or so. So that's all in the U.S. Worldwide, the number of land animals killed for human consumption in 2006 was 56,416,700,000. And if you'd like these numbers in more personal terms, I can do that for you too. During a 75-year lifespan, a typical U.S. resident is responsible for the suffering and death of 10 cows, 34 pigs, 2,535 turkeys, ducks, and chickens, and an uncounted number of fishes and other aquatic animals. So I think that helps put it in a little more perspective, because I know I have a hard time wrapping my brain around those really high numbers. And again, you can find this, I'll put this on the message board, but you can find these numbers all at the Farm Animal Reform Movement. As I said, chickens raised for their flesh are called broilers by the chicken industry, and they spend their entire lives in filthy, disgusting sheds with tens of thousands of other birds, where intense crowding and confinement lead to serious outbreaks of disease. Because they're bred and drugged to grow so large so quickly, their legs and organs can't keep up, making heart attacks and organ failure and crippling leg deformities common. Many become crippled under their own weight and eventually die because they can't reach the water. In fact, by the age of 6 weeks, 90% of broiler chickens are so obese that they can no longer walk. When they're only 6 or 7 weeks old, they're crammed into cages and trucked to slaughter. 6 weeks old, they're babies. They're bred to grow to full size in 6 weeks, a process that would naturally take 6 months. Those chickens labeled organic or free range are killed at 14 weeks. So you choose 14 weeks, 6 weeks. It's all the same to them. Chickens in nature may live for 5 to 11 years, depending on the breeds. Regarding birds exploited for their eggs, these are called laying hens or layers by the industry. They are crammed together in wire cages where they don't have enough room to spread a single wing. The cages are stacked up on top of each other, and the excrement for chickens in the higher cages constantly falls on those below. And as you know, the birds have part of their sensitive beaks cut off, so they won't peck at each other as a result of the frustration created by the unnatural confinement. After their bodies are exhausted and their production drops, they're shipped to slaughter as well, as I said, and they're turned into chicken soup or something. By the way, I encourage you to check out Peaceful Prairie's website. Their website is peacefulprairie.org, and again, I'll put this up on the message board, but they have a new video called The Faces of Free Range Farming, and I think it's pretty remarkable. They did some investigations of a free-range farm, and you can see there really is no difference between what I'm talking about here and those that label themselves free-range. So just as an aside, I encourage you to check that out. And the truth is that, you know, in all these cases, you have to have animals that are kept for breeding, specifically for breeding. So in addition to the broilers that are raised specifically for their flesh, and in addition to the layers that are raised specifically for their eggs, there is a whole other group called the breeders, right? Dr. Joy Mensch is a poultry scientist at the University of California, and she refers to the breeding animals who give birth to the 9 billion broiler chickens killed in the U.S. as Gallus neglectatus, or neglected chickens, because their welfare is completely ignored. So these are the animals that are kept specifically to breed all the other animals that we kill and eat. And like the broiler chickens to whom they give birth, breeder chickens are also confined in these filthy sheds without access to sunlight or fresh air or anything else they would enjoy in nature. And they too experience the hot blade when they're just babies, and they have large chunks of their beaks cut off so they don't peck at each other out of frustration. And sometimes their toes and their spurs and their combs are also cut off. The birds are not given any painkillers, as you know, to ease the agony of this mutilation. And many debeaked chickens starve to death because they're in too much pain. They can't eat the food. So whereas broilers are killed for their flesh after 6 weeks, unfortunately for the breeder chickens, they're forced to live in these horrific conditions for more than a year. Now, these are bred also to grow very large very quickly, but they live so much longer and they face an even higher risk of organ failure and death because they just keep growing larger and larger. And in an attempt to fix the problem, you know, within their context, of course, they're not going to stop breeding them this way. They drastically limit the feed given to these breeding birds, trying to keep the animal's weight down trying to keep them from growing so rapidly, which is impossible to do because this has been genetically altered in them. So what they do is they keep the animals in a constant state of hunger and frustration. And so the birds often drink more water to try to relieve their hunger, but the animal factory operators often reduce this drinking water so they don't have to clean up wet manure, because their manure is a lot looser. Obviously, it's a lot wetter. And some farmers shove thin plastic rods through the nasal cavities of male breeding birds, and the rods stick out of both sides of their faces, preventing them from reaching through the wire barrier to eat the female's food. So they're starving and they just want to eat, but they stop them from eating in all of these different ways. And when I picture this rod going through the nasal cavity of a rooster, I can't help thinking of some of the contraptions I've seen put on black slaves in the U.S. that were put on their faces, these kind of metal contraptions. One of them I remember seeing was this metal contraption that stopped them from running away, but it also stopped them from killing themselves. For those who wanted to get out so desperately, they would commit suicide by shoving dirt down their throats to suffocate themselves. So the slave masters would devise these horrific contraptions to stop this from happening. And I just picture the same stuff. It's all the same thing when I picture this bar being stuck through the nasal cavity of a bird and stopping him from eating. After more than a year of deprivation and confinement, the bodies of these breeding birds are too worn out to produce enough chicks anymore for the farmer to sell, and they're completely exhausted and frail and broken when they are sent to slaughter. These are vocal, sensitive, maternal, social, curious animals, and in their whole lives, they never have the chance to do anything natural. They will never meet their parents, let alone be raised by them. They will never take dust baths. They will never feel the sun on their backs. They will never breathe fresh air. They will never roost in trees, which is natural to them. They will never build nests. These are things that birds do. I remember my father saying to me once many years ago, he said, you know, Carl, I was thinking, I feed my birds out here in the feeder every day. I throw them bread. I love watching them eat. I love watching them gather around and watching all of their social interactions. And I would feel really bad if any harm came to them. And I was thinking, chickens and turkeys, they're birds. And that's all he said. You know, he just made this connection, a connection that I think we forget. These are birds. Imagine giving money to some crazy scientists, some mad scientists, to come up with ways to genetically manipulate and breed the sparrows that you love in your yard, or the wrens or the hawks or whatever you see in your own experience outside of your home and through your window. Imagine giving them money to breed these animals, genetically alter these animals to make them grow really fast and really large, and you know, and watch them unable to function in these freakish bodies. Imagine for just a moment separating a mother bird from her young, these young who are so vulnerable and they want only to be under the warmth of their mother's wing. Imagine, you know, kind of separating these animals and listening to their cries. Imagine sticking those birds into filthy cages or sheds, you know, birds who want to fly. That's what they do. Imagine hurting them. Imagine cutting them. Imagine killing them. This is what we pay for. This is what we pay to do to billions of animals. But because we don't see it, we don't really know that it's happening. And look, I'm not naive. I know there are people who say that they have no problem killing animals, that it doesn't affect them one bit. People on small farms who will tell you that they do this in a humane way. They do this without any pain or suffering to the animal. And these are just animals, so they have no problem doing this. And it's not part of the whole industrialized system, so they think it's better. And you know, they can do it. It doesn't affect them. And I have to be really honest with you. I don't believe them. I believe the extent to which we are capable of compartmentalizing our feelings and blocking our emotions is such that we can do just about anything to ourselves. We can do anything to each other, and we can do anything to other beings without flinching. Sure, they're able to compartmentalize those emotions, but to my mind, that does not a whole person make. That's not optimum. That's not what we want to strive for, compartmentalizing our emotions, blocking things out, becoming desensitized to another's suffering. And every single person I've ever read about or heard talk about growing up on a small farm where animals were kept and killed, where they also had to kill the animals, every single person I know talks about the process of desensitization that they go through in order to make it possible to kill these animals or to sell these animals to be killed. They all talk about the difficulty they have bonding with these animals or naming these animals because they know they're going to send them off to be killed. But we can tell ourselves anything we need to in order to justify what we do. And eventually, it doesn't bother us anymore. Anyone who's ever killed an animal for this purpose will tell you that it was hard in the beginning, but after a while, you don't feel like you're killing an animal anymore. You don't feel like you're branding an animal or hurting an animal or mutilating an animal or cutting the throat of a live animal. You don't feel like you're killing an animal. You become desensitized to your own feelings and you become emotionally compartmentalized. And I'm talking about, you know, relatively high functioning adults killing animals on small farms. And I think it's really sad that this process takes place for people because I think it also affects our relations with one another, our relationship with ourselves. And most of this is done when they're very young children. But what happens when you put these folks, high functioning adults, into an inherently violent situation, normal everyday folks? What about people who have a less steady foundation? Perhaps they grew up in an abused household. Perhaps they were desensitized to violence towards humans and non-humans when they were very young. Perhaps they're poor and desperate. Perhaps they've been exploited. Perhaps these people have been disenfranchised. Perhaps they're alcoholics. What happens when you put someone with that profile into an inherently violent situation? Well, we know what happens, and it's not pretty. In addition to what I've read in Gail Eisnitz's book, Slaughterhouse, the book that was the catalyst for my becoming vegan, for my becoming fully aware and fully awake, there have been numerous undercover investigations of slaughterhouses and poultry processing plants, some of which have been conducted by PETA. These investigations have often been conducted at Tyson or Purdue slaughterhouses. So I've read enough about this, I've seen enough about this to know that when you put someone in a terribly violent situation, they're going to be terribly violent people. Now, you can certainly choose to turn off the podcast right now, as what I'm about to read is indeed very difficult to hear and very painful. But if you choose to listen, I encourage you to take a deep breath and know that nothing I'm about to say will harm you, not really, though it may pain us to our very core to hear what happens to these animals. We are not the victims. By knowing this information, we can better speak on behalf of those who have no voice. They need us to be strong, so I encourage you to listen. You can read more about PETA's investigations on their website, and you can obviously watch video, but here's just some of what the investigators found. During two 2007 investigations on 9 separate days, PETA's investigator saw workers urinating in the live hang area, including on the conveyor belt that moves the birds to slaughter. That's one thing that's really striking when you read Gail Eisnitz's book, is how dirty and disgusting everything is. You know, nothing against rats, but I mean, just imagine, these are things that people are thinking they're eating that are healthful and clean, and there's rats everywhere and excrement everywhere and blood everywhere and urine everywhere and cockroaches everywhere and maggots everywhere. And these are things that happen on a daily basis. There's one section of the book where she talks about workers telling her that because they would be fired if they slowed the line down, the workers don't take breaks. They are scared to go to the bathroom. And many of them will hold it and be in a lot of discomfort and pain. Obviously, it's not good to do that to your body, but a lot of them will relieve themselves right there on the floor. And so I'm talking about liquid and solid excrement on the floor. And often the animals, both dead and alive, fall on the floor and they're picked up and put right back onto the line. So these are the kinds of things that people are eating. And it's just really striking to see the video and hear the descriptions of these processing plants and these slaughterhouses. It's just really dirty. The investigator also documented sickening cruelty to animals in both the Georgia and Tennessee slaughterhouses. Supervisors at both facilities either were directly involved in the abuse or were made aware of it by the investigator, but they did not stop it. In addition to the cuts and broken limbs suffered by live chickens at nearly every slaughterhouse, the investigator documented the following. One worker admitted that he broke a chicken's back by beating the bird against a rail. A backup killer stabbed birds in the neck area with knives, and several birds were hung from shackles by their necks instead of by their legs. PETA's investigator caught on videotape a supervisor telling him that it was acceptable to rip the heads off of live birds who had been improperly shackled by the head. Workers, sometimes standing 4 to 6 feet away from the conveyor belt, violently threw birds at the shackles. Some animals slammed into the shackles and fell onto birds on the conveyor belt below, at which point the worker sometimes repeated the abuse. Birds died when their heads and legs became trapped under a door at the end of the conveyor belt that transported live birds to be hung. A supervisor was aware of this problem, but did nothing to stop it. The killing machine blade often cut birds' bodies instead of their throats. Although aware of this problem, a supervisor offered no solution, instead blaming the problem on the nature of the machine. Some of you may have heard of a man named Virgil Butler. Virgil worked at the Tyson Chicken Slaughterhouse in Grannis, Arkansas from 1997 to 2002. In testimony that he gave through PETA in January of 2003, Virgil Butler documented the horrific treatment of chickens that he witnessed every single night while working. He became a hero to many people. He changed his life completely, and he spoke out boldly and bravely on behalf of chickens and against the terrible abuse they suffer. He did this at considerable risk to himself, as he lived in a region dominated by Tyson Foods. He died in 2007, but before he did, he became an avid spokesperson for chickens, and he wrote about his experiences in his blog. And again, I'll put this on the message board. His blog is cyberactivist.blogspot.com, and it's still up there. And I'd like to read some of his own words of what he saw in the slaughterhouse. This blog entry of Virgil's is called Inside the Mind of a Killer. And some of what I'm going to read is from that entry. Some of it's from an interview with Satya Magazine in 2006. And he was asked to describe some of the things he saw in the slaughterhouse, and this is what he said. I've seen them shove dry ice up the rectums of chickens to blow them up. I've seen them stuff the head of one inside the rectum of another and so on, making a kind of train of birds. I've seen people bash the birds against the belt, throw them into walls, stomp them, throw them into fans, squeeze them so hard that they would spray feces all over another worker. You could hear the bones pop in their rib cages when they did this. These are just some of the little games people would play. Then there are the supervisor-ordered abuses. I was ordered to pull one-leggers off the line, even if that meant pulling the leg that was hung off of the chicken. When a chicken got her head hung underneath her foot in the shackle, we were ordered to pull her head off. The night shift superintendent himself ordered us to throw runts into the DOA, the dead on arrival dumpster, alive, to be slowly smothered to death by the ones on top, or to be ground up alive by the auger that ground up all of the DOAs and undesirable parts, that, like the bruised areas and the heads and feathers and guts, so they would throw in live birds into this auger. I frequently disobeyed this order by killing the runts first, and was even reprimanded for holding up production once for doing this. And all of this brutality definitely leads to violence outside the factories as well. I know it did with me and others I worked with. Other co-workers became violent towards their own families, even. I know that the longer I worked there, the more violent I became. Life became meaningless. Other people's lives became meaningless. I got to thinking that I had this ability to kill and not care, and others did as well, so I trusted no one. An issue not even thought about by most people, even many of those in the fight for animal rights, is the effects on the minds of those people who do the actual slaughter of the chickens. You see, the killing machine can never slit the throat of every bird that goes by, especially those that the stunner does not stun properly. So you have what is known as a killer, whose job it is to catch those birds so that they are not scalded alive in the tank. Of course, he can't catch them all, but we'll get to that. Now, keep in mind while you read this that the plant I worked at was the smallest Tyson had. They have some that are much bigger, that run hundreds of thousands of birds a shift. Of course, they have more than one killer, but only one per line. They just run more than one line. The birds come through the stunner into the killing machine. It's time to get busy. You can expect to have to catch every fifth one or so, many that are not stunned. Remember, they come at you 182, 186 per minute. There's blood everywhere, in the 3x3x20 trough beneath the machine, on your face, your neck, your arms, all down your apron, you're covered in it. Sometimes you have to wash off the clots of blood without taking your eyes off the line lest one slip by, which they will. You can't catch them all, but you try. Every time you miss one, you hear the awful squawk it's making when you see it flopping around in the scalder, beating itself against the sides. Damn, another red bird. You know that for every one you see suffer like this, there have been as many as 10 you didn't see. You know, you just know this happens. You hope the machine doesn't break down or falter. You just want to get through the night and go home. But it will be a long 2.5 hours until break time, more than 2 hours of killing non-stop. The sheer amount of killing in blood can really get to you after a while, especially if you can't just shut down all emotion completely and turn into a robot zombie of death. You feel like part of a big death machine. Pretty much treated that way as well. Sometimes weird thoughts will enter your head. It's just you and the dying chickens. The surreal feelings grow into such a horror of the barbaric nature of your behavior. You're murdering helpless birds by the thousands, 75,000 to 90,000 a night. You're a killer. Out of desperation, you send your mind elsewhere so that you don't end up like those guys that lose it, like the guy they hauled off to the mental hospital that kept having nightmares that chickens were after him. I've had those too. Very creepy. You find something else to dwell on, to try to remove yourself from the situation, to keep your mind from drowning in all those hundreds of gallons of blood you see. Most people who work this room and work in the hanging cage use some sort of stimulant to keep up the pace and some sort of mellowing substance to escape reality. You begin to feel a sense of disgust at yourself, at what you've done and continue to do. You're ashamed to tell others what you do at night while they're asleep in their beds. You're a killer. You shut down all emotions eventually. You just can't care about anything. Because if you care about something, it opens the gate to all those bad feelings that you can't afford to feel and still do your job. You have bills to pay. You have to eat. But you don't want chicken. You have to be really hungry to eat that. You know what goes into every bite, all the horror, all the negativity, all the brutality concentrated into every bite. You feel isolated from society, not part of it, alone. You know you are different from most people. They don't have visions of horrible death in their heads. They have not seen what you've seen, and they don't want to. They don't even want to hear about it. If they did, how could they eat that next piece of chicken? What Virgil did in exposing all of this, and you can read a lot more on his blog, was incredibly courageous. He was not, as you can imagine, warmly received afterwards, after he left and after what he exposed, and it was difficult to say the least. Whistleblowers, as you may know, are not very popular with the companies and the industries they expose. But if it weren't for people like Virgil Butler and people like Gail Eisnitz and people like the undercover investigators who have the courage and the strength to do what they do, we would never know. I could not do what they do, and I count these people among my heroes. It was Virgil Butler's own awakening, his own transformation, that led him from chicken killer to chicken advocate, and his spirit lives on. One person can make a difference, he wrote, if you just don't shut up. If you keep talking long enough, people will hear you. Thank goodness Virgil did not shut up. He was the voice for chickens when he lived, and a voice that continues to be heard today. May we all find our voice and use it to speak for those who need us most, those who have no voice, those with whom we identify least. For the animals, this is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Truly, thank you for listening.